Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Thank you, Les, and welcome back to Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. Last time, we were looking at the myth of Arethusa, a Greek myth retold by the Latin poet Ovid about a water nymph chased by a river god and finally escaping, or not, depending on which version of the story we follow. This evening under lamplight, I want to look a little further at what happens at the end of that story, and then move over to another story about water deities, this time the nymph being turned on by a young man whom she sees swimming in the pond. It might get a little steamy, so I'll warn you now. As the blurbs for lurid novels say, it's a story about uncontrolled desire. She wanted him, and she had to have him, and her desire changed their lives forever, but not the way she expected. How is that? Does it grab you? Is that an appropriate story for a hot summer's evening? Well, there's lots more to the story, and, of course, you are invited to attend. So, come on over here. You remember the story of Arethusa from the last show, right? Her story can seem, at first, especially to our sensitized ears, like the story of an attempted assault. A male river god, moved by the sight of a woman bathing naked and then assuming his human form, chasing her for a long time, until she finally calls on divine help and is transformed into a river herself and flows down through a crack in the earth, coming up renewed, miles away in Sicily, safe from his advances. Well, that's Ovid's version. Oh, you can hear the archive of our last show, if you'd like, by clicking the Evening Under Lamplight link at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. But we saw that in other versions of the story, this river god, Alpheus, follows her under the ground and comes to her in her new home in Sicily, where she has been transformed into a spring of fresh water and the river that flows out from it. And there Alpheus mingles his waters with hers. And it occurred to me after the show last time that maybe we're rushing into the story too quickly with our modern sensibilities. The myths are open to all sorts of interpretation, and we can hold varying interpretations at the same time. Something caught my attention in the story that made me see it in an entirely different way. I mentioned at the end that Alpheus, like Arethusa, has undergone a mythic death in that passage underground. And that suggested that he too is transformed and reborn up there in Sicily. Arethusa has matured in her rebirth. Might Alpheus also have matured by the time he comes to her? Alpheus is often portrayed, as most river gods are, as an old man river indeed, with long white hair and white beard. But I've seen a few pictures that show him as a young man. And maybe that's a clue for us. The myth gives us no details, so we are free to play around here. At the beginning of the story, Arethusa is an inexperienced adolescent girl, self-conscious and embarrassed by her beauty, and preferring to spend her time among Artemis' sisterhood, hunting, with nothing to do with men or sex. And maybe Alpheus, too, in the beginning of the story, is in a state of inexperienced adolescence. Maybe like a teenage boy, he suddenly gets all excited when a naked girl starts swimming in the waters of his river, and he rises up, can't really help himself, as Arethusa actually acknowledges, and desires her, hardly even aware of the impulses impelling him. But then, going underground, away from his river, losing his sense of power, moving beyond his adolescent ego into something more mature, perhaps he comes up transformed. In mythic terms, he has to come up transformed in some way. And then what? He has come to her in his new identity, having found her true calling as the spring of healing water, no longer, at least as far as we can tell, no longer self-conscious about her beauty. In other words, now, perhaps, she's ready for a man's attentions. And they meet, as I said last time, as equals, river god and river goddess. And now it's not a question of one taking advantage of the other. The two mutually mingle their waters. They come together in love, let's hope. But in any case, the story finishes there, like a dream that suddenly ends, telling us that whatever message it has come to deliver has been delivered. In this interpretation, it's a happy love story, adolescent inexperience, maturing into some kind of mutual mingling and, let's hope, mutual delight.
It would be easier to take the wet from water or the dry from sand than for anyone to try to separate us or stop us from holding hands, 'cause I love you. What love has joined together.
Yes, well, why not? The temptations, what love has joined together. The overdone elegance of the imagery identifies the song as one of Smokey Robinson's. It would be easier to take the wet from water or the dry from sand than for anyone to try to separate us or stop us from holding hands. What love has joined together, can nobody take it apart. Maybe that's what Arethusa and Alpheus sing as their finale. Or maybe not. If our imagination is fine-tuned and well-exercised, then we'll have no trouble holding various contradictory interpretations at once. And now for our next story, which ends with love joining together the couple in a rather different way. I'm thinking of the story of Salmasis and Hermaphroditus, another one of Ovid's little masterpieces from his collection of myths, Metamorphoses. Where shall we start? Well, let's start, as last time, with Ted Hughes' loose but lively translation of Ovid's story. Among those demigods, those perfect girls who sport about the bright source and live in it, the beauty of Salmasis, the water nymph, was perfect. As among damselflies, a damsel flies, as among vipers, the elegance of a viper, or a swan's grace among swans. She was bending to gather lilies for a garland when she spied Hermaphroditus. At that first glance, she knew she had to have him. She felt she trod on prickles until she could touch him. She held back only a moment, checking her girdle, the swing of her hem, her cleavage, let her lust flood hot and startled into her cheek, eyes, lips, made her whole face open as a flower that offers itself wet with nectar. Then she spoke. "Do you mind if I say you are beautiful? Seen from where I stand, you could be a god. Are you a god? If you are human, well, what a lucky sister. As for the mother who held you and pushed her nipple between your lips, I'm already sick with envy of her. I dare not think of a naked wife in your bed. If she exists, I dare not think of her bliss. Let me beg a taste, one little sip of her huge happiness, a secret between us. But if you're unmarried, here I am. Let us lie down and make our own bridal bed where we can love each other to sleep and awaken each other." The boy blushed. He had no idea what she was talking about. Her heart lurched again when she saw how his blush bewildered his beauty. Like the red side of an apple against a sunset, or the ominous dusky flush that goes over the cold moon when the eclipse grips its edge and begins to swallow it inch by inch, in spite of all the drums and pans and gongs beaten on earth beneath to protect it. Then the nymph slid her arms around his neck and asked for a kiss, one kiss, one brotherly kiss. "Go away," he cried, "let me go, or I'm off. And you can sit here on your basket of tricks all by yourself." That scared Salmasis. She thought he really might go. "Oh, no, forgive me," she sobbed. "Forgive me. I couldn't help it. I'm going. Oh, I'm spoiling this lovely place for you. I'm going. I'm going." So, lingering her glances, she goes. And truly, she seems to have gone. In fact, she has ducked behind a bush. And there she kneels, motionless, head lifted, her eye fixed like the eye of a leopard. He plays, careless as a child, roams about happily, thinking he's utterly alone. He paddles into the pool's edge, goes deeper. The cool pulse of the spring, warping the clarity, massages his knees. Delicious. He peels off his tunic, and the air makes free with all that had been hidden, freshens his nudity. Under the leaves, Salmacis groaned softly and began to tremble. As the sun catches a twisting mirror surface with a splinter of glare, her own gaze flamed and hurt her. She was already up and leaping towards him. She had grabbed him with all her strength, yet she still crouched where she was, shaking all over, letting this go through her like a dreadful cramp. She watched him slap his pale shoulders, hugging himself, and slap his belly to prepare it for the plunge, and then plunge forward. And suddenly he was swimming, ahead bobbing, chin surging through the build of bow wave, shoulders liquefied, legs as if at home in the frog's grotto. With a heave of luster, limpid as air, like a man of ivory glossed in glass or a lily in a bulb of crystal. "I've won!" shrieked Salmacis. "He's mine!" She could not help herself. "He's mine!" she laughed, and with a couple of bounds hit the pool stark naked in a rocking crash and thump of water, the slips of her raiment settling wherever they happened to fall. Then out of the upheaval, her arms reach and wind round him, and slippery as the roots of the big lilies, but far stronger, her legs below wind round him. He flounders and goes under, all his strength fighting to keep back up through a cloud of bubbles, leaving him helpless to her burrowing kisses. Burning for air, he can do nothing as her hands hunt over him, and as her body knots itself every way around him, like a sinewy otter hunting some kind of fish that flees hither and thither inside him, and as she flings and locks her coils around him like a snake around the neck and legs and wings of an eagle that is trying to fly off with it, and like ivy, which first binds the branches in its meshes, then pulls the whole tree down, and as the octopus, a tangle of constrictors nippled with suckers that drag towards a maw, embraces its prey. But still, Hermaphroditus kicks to be free and will not surrender or yield her the least kindness of the pleasure she longs for and rages for and pleads for as she crushes her breasts and face against him and clings to him with every inch of her surface. "It's no good struggling," she hisses. "You can strain, wrestle, squirm, but cannot ever get away from me now. The gods are listening to me. The gods have agreed we never, never shall be separated, you and me." The gods heard her frenzy and smiled. And there, in the giddy boil, the two bodies melted into a single body, seamless as the water.
Ooh, the moon above is shining bright. Come on, boy. There's a mist of ecstasy that's flowing over me. Here I am, take me in your arms and love me. Oh, baby, my love is good, my love is sweet. Now's the time that all is sweet. Hold me on, don't hesitate. I need you now, don't make me wait. You're the one that I adore. Tell me what I.
Well, it looks like this might be an all Motown show this evening. That was Gladys Knight and the Pips with Sal Mass's song, Take Me in Your Arms and Love Me. Motown didn't really shy away from passionate love, but this song, I think, is a rare example of the way they let one of their acts rip loose with erotic fervor. The song is pretty explicit about the sexual desires she has for this guy. Let's just run through the lyrics. The moon above is shining bright. Come on, boy, the time is right. Here I am, take me in your arms and love me. Okay, it's pretty tame to start with, but let's see what happens next. There's a mist of ecstasy that's flowing over me. Here I am, take me in your arms and love me. My love is new, my love is sweet. Now's the time that I'll be sweet. That's odd to repeat the same word for the rhyme, but hold me, boy, don't hesitate. I need you now, don't make me wait. You're the one that I adore. Tell me what you're waiting for. Here I am, take me in your arms and love me. Boy, I'm hungry for your love. Give me what I'm in need of. Here I am, take me in your arms and love me. Come, let's share the joy and splendor of this moment, warm and tender. Hold me tight, kiss me long. Make this night one sweet song. My eager heart is pounding fast. Don't lose the feeling, make it last. Here I am, take me in your arms and love me. Take me higher with the touch that thrills me, darling, oh so much. Here I am, take me in your arms and love me. I didn't think I was going to read it so expressively, but there we are. It's overpowering me, too. Not finished yet. This feeling is too strong to hold. Any second now, I'll explode. Now's the time, now's the time. Take all of this love of mine. I'll be true to you. Do what you want me to. Take me in your arms. Take me in your arms and love me.
Baby, baby, this feeling is too strong to hold.
Yes, bring up those passionate violins, guys. All right, back to the story of Salmasis and Hermaphroditus. We heard Ted Hughes' version, let's go further into the story. Salmasis, as we've heard, was a water nymph like Arethusa from last week. But remember the way Arethusa used to love the company of Artemis, Diana, and her sisterhood of young women who had no interest in anything but hunting. But Salmasis was different. She had no interest in hunting. Sola qua naiadum celerino nota dianae. This is, you get a free little Latin tag here. It costs you nothing extra. She was the only one of the naiads not numbered among swift Diana's throng. Instead, she would just hang around her own pool of Caria. As Melville says, sticking more closely to Ovid than Ted Hughes, in her pool, she would bathe her lovely limbs and with a comb of boxwood dress her hair and, gazing long, take counsel of the waters what style were best. Now on the soft green grass or on soft leaves in gauzy dress she lay. Now she gathered flowers. She sounds like some vain, flighty girl, but maybe these details just tell us that she was passing out of her innocent adolescence and was now ready for love, as those other maids were not. And it was while she was gathering flowers one day that she spotted Hermaphroditus approaching her pool. But now, who was Aphroditus? Hermaphroditus? You won't be too surprised to hear that he was the child of both Hermes and Aphrodite, hence, you see, his name, Hermaphroditus. It was quite an impressive heritage. From his mother, Aphrodite, the goddess of love, he inherited his amazing beauty. And from his father, well, I don't know. Hermes is the trickster god, wily, witty, humorous, leading people down paths they would never have taken unless they were somehow tricked into going that way. A path that leads underground into a chthonic death experience, but always ending in good fortune. Does this sound like the young man we meet in the story? Does it perhaps explain the trickery that Dad was throwing into his son's way, including that underground experience when he was dragged under the waters? Well, Hermaphroditus was wandering around one day when he came across the pool of Caria, that is, Salmacis' pool. And so the two come together in the same spot. And so our story begins. Ovid is quite frank about Salmacis' desire for this beautiful boy she'd just seen. Her heated blood pushed her to rush right over to him, but she paused for a few minutes to calm herself and check that her dress was hanging in just the right way and compose her face to look its most beautiful. And then she approached Hermaphroditus. Her speech is a parody of a famous speech in the Odyssey, but let's not get into that now. The speech is very polite, full of compliments about his beauty. You're so beautiful, you can easily be taken for a god. Or if you are a god, you must be Cupid. And then, by extension, she exclaims how blessed it must be his fiancée or his wife. That woman who is your wife must be really blessed. If you have a wife, and if you do have a wife, let me steal you from her for a while. Or if you have no wife, then let me be your wife. In other words, let's make a marriage bed right here and now. Poor Hermaphroditus, innocent boy, has no idea what she's talking about. Nescit enim quid amor, as Ovid puts it. And he blushes bright red. But blushing just made him even more attractive. Okay, Salmacis quickly says, trying to play it cool. Sorry about that marriage bed stuff. How about just a little sisterly kiss? And she was just about to put her arms around him when he backed off. Leave me alone or I'm going away from this place and from you. Whoa, okay, says Salmacis. I get your meaning. I'll leave you in peace here. Sorry to have caused you any embarrassment. And she turns to go. But not very far. She knows the place well and just hides behind a convenient bush and watches what comes next. Hermaphroditus takes her at her word and feels he's alone now. He walks around a bit, just to make sure, perhaps, and then, like Arethusa from last time you'll recall, he tentatively enters the water, first just his toes, then his feet, and then throws off his clothes, ready to dive in. You can imagine how much hotter Salmacis becomes when she sees him naked there. As Ovid says, her eyes blazed bright as when the sun's unclouded orb shines dazzling in a mirror. The boy slaps his palms against his thighs, as one does, right, before one dives into a pool, and plunges into the water, swimming with wet arms glistening in the sun, and she can hold herself back no longer. He's now in the water, and she is, after all, a water nymph. This is her element. Vicimus et meus est. I've won. He's mine, she cries out. And pulling off her clothes as she runs to the water, she takes a mighty dive far out into the pool and grabs the swimming boy. But he still resists, and she still persists. Here's Ovid again. As he struggled, she forced her kisses, willy-nilly fondled him, caressed him, now on one side, now on the other, clung to him as he fought to escape her hold, and so at last entwined him, wrapping her arms and legs around him. And the more he fought, the tighter she clung. "Fool," she said, "fight me as you will, you'll not escape. Oh, you gods, ordain no day shall ever dawn to part us two." The gods hear this prayer, and now comes the metamorphosis. She wanted them never to part, and that's what happens. The bodies begin to merge into each other. One shape, one face. Nec duo sunt et forma duplex, nec femina dici, nec puer ut possit, neutrumque et utrumque videntur. They were two no more, neither woman nor boy. The one body had the shape of neither of them, and yet also of both of them. They had been transformed into what we now call a hermaphrodite, a person with both male and female characteristics. But what exactly this new person looked like, well, I don't know. Nor I'm sure does anyone else. The most common guess is female breasts and male genitalia. I suppose that's easiest to depict in a painting or sculpture. But maybe we can say that they have overcome that perennial problem of how two separate people can find harmony as a couple. After all, to continue our Motown connection, after all, it takes two, doesn't it?
One can have a dream, baby. Two can make that dream. A dream come true. Just take two. One can have a broken heart living in misery.
Two can really ease the pain like a perfect remedy.
One can be alone in a crowd like an island he's all alone.
Two can make it just an inner place.
Marvin Gaye and Kim Weston, It Takes Two. And in our story, the two have come together as one. And to make a brief transition, it certainly takes two to make a radio show complete. Me and you, as the song says. And me, I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and you are listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio. We're attending to the myth of Salmasis and Hermaphroditus. But we're not quite finished with the story. We'll continue after this.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend. Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio. When the day comes to an end, he invites you... No. When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend. It's Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio. It's Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Thank you, Neil Henry. Well, so Salmis's prayer was answered and the two of them were joined forever in one body. When Hermaphroditus realized that he had plunged into the water as a man but had now lost half his strength, he was anguished, and now it was his turn to send up a prayer. He had connections, remember, and he asked, in a much higher voice than ever before, he asked his parents, Hermes and Aphrodite, two very powerful deities, to grant his wish that any time a man should bathe in these waters, he would come out of there half a woman, a semi-weir in the Latin, a half-man. And his divine parents consented, and thus it is to this day, so we're told, that these waters effect that amazing alteration on any man who ventures in. The story leaves us with lots of questions, doesn't it? First of all, I wonder what would happen if a woman bathed in the pool. We're not told that this transformation would work on her, only that it would work on a man who enters the water. But more important is the question of why Hermaphroditus comes out with such an odd request. What good does it do? We saw last time that Arethusa asked a very practical request of her goddess Artemis to save her from the advances of a man she wanted to escape from. And Salmis's request was also practical, though a little rash. May the two of us never be separated. Is she happy now? We're simply not told. Does she even have a voice anymore? We never hear her speak. Only Hermaphroditus speaks. It seems like he's speaking out of spite. If I have to put up with this half loss of my manhood, then I wish everyone else who comes here will suffer as I am. That's pretty nasty, isn't it? And why is Hermaphroditus suddenly so concerned with his manhood? He was only an innocent boy a few minutes ago. Has this been his real transformation, to become aware of his masculinity, but only once it has been diminished? Is this the rite of passage out of adolescence, this refinement of the strong male ego by adding to it the softening, less macho influence of his anima, his feminine side? Well, lots of wise people tell us that we never truly mature into an adult self until we can consciously assume both our male and our female characteristics. Can we then perhaps understand that Hermaphroditus has been transformed into a mature man and is actually in a tone of joy, that it is only in a tone of joy that he begs that all men who come here may also open up to their anima, to the feminine side of their nature, and share his joyful, mature manhood? Is his prayer, in fact, not spiteful, but an act of goodwill to all adolescent boys? And this story, being a myth unbound by realistic details, can externalize that inner male-female union by showing an actual physical union of the two characteristics, the boy made a man by subsuming into himself that strong passion for beauty from the woman, which raises and completes his immature boyish innocence. And perhaps Salmis's self-centered sexuality has now also become more mature once she has been united with the object of her desire. Yes? Maybe? I know, I'm forcing it a little here, but that's where I'll leave it for the moment. The myths are alive and keep shifting around as we live with them. Let me know how it looks to you. Get me at lamplight@cambridge105.co.uk. Who knows? Maybe next time I'll return with a whole new way of looking at it. But before we leave the story, here's one more Motown song, this time from Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. Not one of their best by a long shot, but there's always something fascinating about Smokey's chutzpah in piling up his metaphysical imagery in the service of saying very simple feelings. I have to read you, if I can keep a straight face, I have to read you some of the lyrics of this song so you can see what I mean. The song is called I'm Stuck on You. You see its application to Salmasis and Hermaphroditus. Now, watch how Smokey runs the gamut of different images of being stuck to something. Here's the first line. Just look at the wallpaper. Now, is that chutzpah or not? What kind of way is that to begin a song? And of course, we can see immediately where he's going to go with this. Just look at the wallpaper stuck there on the wall. It's a pretty sight. It's stuck so tight, you'd think that it would never fall off at all. But if this isn't pathetic enough, listen to what comes next. It takes some real hot water and a sponge or a rag and soap and water till the paper starts to sag. Remember that Bob Dylan called Smokey the greatest living poet in America, but maybe he wasn't thinking of this doggerel. It takes some real hot water and a sponge or a rag and soap and water till the paper starts to sag, and pretty soon that paper gotta fall. But if you soak me, man, well, if you soak me, I'll make a bet. I won't be free. I'll just be wet. But still, I will be stuck on you. I love that. I won't be free. I'll just be wet. Sometimes in the winter, this is the next verse, sometimes in the winter it's better to stay inside. Where's he going to go now? Though it's pretty and white, the car is stuck so tight till the wheels just slip and slide. But take some ashes or salt, whatever you desire, and if that don't make you move, put some chains round the tire, and pretty soon you're ready to take a ride. And so on. That's enough. I'll bet you're dying to hear the song itself. Well, here it is. We get the point, don't we? Let's just stop there. And we'll come back to it maybe at another time. We'll have a show on pathetic music. Well, we've just been attending to, as you know, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and I'm Stuck on You. Perhaps the first time it has ever been heard on radio. Perhaps the last time, too. It's as though someone bet Smokey to see if he could impose his famous quavering voice onto the most banal lyrics and turn it into a musical performance. You heard it here, folks. Evening Under Lamplight. Now there's another connection with the story of Salmasis and Hermaphroditus. We looked at it a little over a year ago when we were descending with Dante through the pit of hell. When Dante comes to the Circle of Thieves, he finds a region filled with snakes, serpents, and other such-like creatures, all interacting with the sinners there. As in each area of the inferno, the punishment of the sinners is, on another level, a metaphorical enactment of the state of the soul of any of us if we give ourselves over to the particular sin. In Dante's time, someone's property was regarded as part of that person's identity. And so if you steal someone's possessions, you're also stealing their identity and losing your own, in the sense that having the other person's goods, you're taking on that other person's identity and losing yours. And these serpents are the agents for this confusion of identity. Dante brags, justifiably so, penso io, in my opinion, that he's outdoing even the great master of metamorphosis, Ovid. Look what he depicts as he stares down at a group of three thieves. Catch the way Dante is basing this on Salmasus and Hermaphroditus' story, but going one better. While I stood staring with raised brows, a reptile with six legs propelled itself at one of them and fastened itself to him. It grabbed his belly with its middle claws, then with its forepaws held his arms and bit him on both cheeks. It stretched its hind feet down the other's thighs, thrusting its tail between them, and curled it up behind, above the buttocks. Never did clinging ivy fix itself so tight upon a tree as did that fearsome beast entwine itself around the other's limbs. Then they fused together, as if made of molten wax, mixing their colors so that neither seemed what it had been before. The other two thieves were looking on, and each was shouting, "Oh my, Agnello, how you change! Look, now you're neither two nor one." Already the two heads had been united, two sets of features blending, both lost in a single face. Four separate limbs combined to form two arms, the thighs and calves, the stomach and the chest turned into members never seen before. All trace of their first aspect was erased, and the unnatural figure seemed both two and none, and lumbered off at its slow pace.
Hold it. Listen.
I can turn the gray sky blue.
I can make it rain whenever I want it to.
Continuing our Motown music, that was The Temptations, back again, later in their career, their psychedelic phase, and a sparkling performance, declaring, "I can't get next to you." Maybe he should be grateful, seeing what happened to this Agnello in the Inferno, who got a little too close to that other. And it goes out for Neil Henry, who always loved that cool piano opening. I seem to have backed myself into a corner of my own making, granted, by mixing this interesting myth with all these Motown songs. And Il Mio Maestro Dante, too, thrown in at the end. It's a strange mix. Does it work? Who am I to say? But we've shared it here this evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio, you and me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. And a final Motown offering, now with Marvin Gaye back again in his later guise as a sexual healer, giving us a more mature version of Salmas's unrestrained erotic passion. The song is Let's Get It On, just as urgent as Salmas's, but much more respectful, I think, as he asks her if she's ready, and if she agrees, then they can get it on. "I ain't gonna push you, baby," he says, though he does everything but push, as he urges her to come together with him in a less macabre way, to be sure, than the coming together of Salmas's and Hermaphroditus. So here to see us out is Marvin Gaye. Let's get it on.
Since we got to be